It's Monday, March the 12th, 2018. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Well, good evening and welcome to a podcast I am really excited about. I have debated of whether to publish this as three separate podcasts or just one, and probably in the name of laziness, I'm going to publish it all as one, but as podcasting tools have gotten easier, I still find myself with this podcast channel using several different tools and having a workflow that takes me a little bit longer to get things together. So it's just going to be a lot more efficient this evening to publish this as a single podcast. But what I'd like to do is reflect just briefly on a new podcasting channel, or I guess tool, that I've started to use and I'm really excited about, Anchor. And I'll talk a little bit about that. And then I'm going to play three different podcast interviews. First, an interview with our 17-year-old daughter, Sarah, who is going to talk about her experiences taking concurrent classes, both face-to-face and online, from two different Oklahoma colleges this year, from the University of Central Oklahoma and from OCCC, the Oklahoma County Community College, which is a 2-year school, and UCO is a 4-year school. And so she has done that and I think has some important perspectives. And certainly if you are in the Oklahoma City area and you've got kids who are approaching that senior year or in that senior year, it's really important to know about the availability of concurrent classes and think about some of those benefits. And one of the things I think is just great is it's given her an opportunity to really dip her toe into some college classes and some of the responsibilities and differences in terms of time management and, you know, responsibility that come with having independent classes. So that'll be the first interview. The second one will be an interview from today with Eric Ebert, who is the computer science teacher at our upper division at Cassidy School. And I've learned from Eric that he's been using GitHub and also audio podcasts with his students. And so I wanted to chat with him and learn a little bit more. And so I published that on a podcast channel just for our school called Cassidy Voices, which I've now migrated over to Anchor. But I got his permission to also publish and share that here, and I'll include some links in the show notes to some of the referenced resources, an example of a GitHub coding project and an audio reflection that they did that's on SoundCloud, as well as a link to his Twitter if you want to get in contact with him. And then last of all, the longest portion of this podcast is going to be an interview that I had this evening with my wonderful wife, Shelley Fryer, who is teaching third grade at our school, but has been doing a series of after school classes for kids on coding using PBS Scratch Junior and also the full-blown Scratch. And so our interview, I think, runs about 40 minutes. So this podcast will probably be a little bit over an hour, a little bit longer than normal. But as always, I would welcome any feedback or comments that you might have. You can leave those on the podcast, which you're hopefully finding at speedofcreativity.org. You can also reach out to me on Twitter at WFryer. So what I'd like to do first before playing these recorded podcasts is just briefly tell you a little bit about Anchor. Anchor.fm is a website and also a mobile application that I had heard about and maybe just played with a little bit. But in the last couple weeks, I think as a result of some pretty substantial venture capital funding, Anchor is now providing free podcast hosting for anyone. And I really love the way that they are simplifying the process of creating podcasts. You can go to their web version, and number one, you can import all past episodes to include the audio file as well as the show art that you might have with that episode, along with the title and the date. You can just import it straight into Anchor and then have Anchor become your place for not only publishing and sharing your podcast, but also creating it. Anchor will append to the end of your podcast a little audio bumper that says this was created with Anchor. One of the places I've been hearing about Anchor a lot is actually on our Google Home. We've got several Google Home Mini smart assistants, and I love being able to play and listen to podcasts and also my news briefing, generally in the morning, but sometimes when I come home from school as well. And several of those are now created with Anchor. I think there's one called The Outline that's daily tech headlines, and you can use the Google Home application on either your iPhone or your Android phone to, you know, order the news and select different news sources and things like that. So if you are interested in podcasting or oral history, I really encourage you to check out Anchor. I actually imported over 200 episodes that I had published over on the website Audioboo, and these go back to at least 2011, maybe even earlier. And I've listened to several of these in the last couple days. This weekend, I imported my podcast over because I had thought that Audioboo is going to actually discontinue and maybe terminate the old episodes. It appears at this point they've left old ones up, and maybe I'm fortunate to have my channel, you know, still up. But anyway, like some other podcasting services like Opinion in the past few months that has discontinued hosting for free, Audioboo has gone that way as well. So if you want to, you can check out my eclectic recordings, which at this point are basically things that I'd recorded over on mainly Audioboo and Audioboom when it was named Audioboom. But I also, I think, had moved some other audio recordings from Cinch and some other places that are now websites that are gone. But you can find that at anchor.fm/wfryer. You can also find our school podcast channel, which I've got about 5 or 6 interviews. Maybe this was the 7th interview with Eric today, that is on anchor.fm/Cassady, C-A-S-A-D-Y. And I would point you to the podcast show notes, where I will include some referenced links to projects that Shelley talks about, resources for coding, some of the student projects she mentions, as well as those that Eric mentions in his. So without further ado, we'll turn the clock back to this past Saturday with the interview with Sarah, and then we'll hear from Eric Ebert and Shelley Fryer. Hello, today is Saturday, March the 10th, 2018. This is Wes Fryer. I am here with my daughter, Sarah Fryer, who's 17 and is a senior in high school and is agreed under somewhat duress to tell us about her experiences, because even though she doesn't realize it, I think there are probably few seniors today who have taken concurrent classes from two different Oklahoma colleges. And so, welcome, Sarah. Can you tell us a little about yourself and some of your school background and goals at this point?
Well, my name is Sarah Fryer, and I'm 17, and I go to Klassen School of Advanced Studies, which is kind of a special school. It is 6th grade through 12th grade, so I've been there for a total of 7 years. The one really special thing about Klassen is that you have a major. So there's an art side, and then there is a international baccalaureate side, and I'm on the art side, and I am a drama major. And so I just got done with my big musical of the year, which was Hairspray, and that was a lot of fun. And I've been really fortunate to be able to this year to take classes from two different colleges. So.
Now, even before this year, you took a lot of the IB classes, even though you were a VPA major. Can you talk about how that has gone? Was that easy, hard, and why did you do that?
That is correct, yes. I took some of the IB classes.
English or more than English?
English and chemistry.
Right.
And history. But I don't know. I just found that I thrived more in an atmosphere with those type of students.
More academically focused and a more sort of challenging academic environment. Okay. Well, what made you decide to take concurrent this year, your senior year? Because you didn't have to.
No, I didn't. I had pretty much already gone through all of the classes that Classen had to offer that I was interested in. And a lot of other people seemed to be doing concurrent too, and it just seemed like the right move for me.
Okay. So in the fall, you took two concurrent classes at the University of Central Oklahoma, which is in Edmond. Tell us a little bit about what your experiences were like doing that.
Well, I took one online class and one in-person class. The in-person class was at UCO downtown, which was actually very convenient for me since my school is downtown. But
and that was algebra.
Right. College algebra. And then the online class that I took was government.
Yeah, it was in the political science department.
Yeah, it was government.
Right. So what were those experiences like in terms of class sizes, classmates, and teachers?
Well, I really enjoyed the UCO Downtown College Algebra class. There were about, 15 people in my class, and it met twice a week, Monday, Wednesday. And I really enjoyed it. It was easy. It wasn't easy, but it was not hard. It was more of like a, you're getting into college, here's some review on stuff that you've already done. It was kind of like a nice merger into
transition
into what college classes would be like. I, on the other hand, did not have such a great experience with my other class, the online one. It just was not formatted well, and
the instructor was kind of a bully.
Yeah, it wasn't the best, but with my next experiences, which we'll be talking about here in a little bit, it has not totally barred me from taking online classes in the future.
One of the things I remember that happened is we went to see your brother in Colorado, and your teacher had, I guess, sent an email on Thursday saying there was a pop quiz and you had to turn it in by Saturday night. Was that right?
It was like a really fast turnaround.
And there was no makeup or whatever. And anyway, so it just didn't seem to be as well organized. What did you find to be most challenging about your fall classes?
Well, it definitely was challenging to have to... Well, there was reading that you had to get done for the history class, and I wasn't necessarily very good at keeping up with my reading. But that taught me in the class that I'm taking now that it's very important to stay on top of your reading for class.
What would you say were some of the benefits or advantages of taking the concurrent classes? Obviously, you get the college credit, but in terms of any other benefits you saw?
It gave me some flexibility with my high school schedule, so that's nice. And it also gave me some experience just with being on my own some and having to make my own decisions, drive myself places, and kind of gave me a little bit more freedom than just normal 8 classes in one school building.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Classen's on a block schedule, so you all have 8 classes and 4 A day, 4 B day. And so for concurrent, that freed up actually 2 high school classes per college class, right?
Right.
So you ended up taking 4 high school classes and then 2 college classes.
Correct.
Instead of 8 college classes. Do you think that's reasonable as far as the workload and homework and all that?
Definitely, yeah. And I know some people who've taken more than just 2, and I think that's too much.
Okay. So how did things work out at Classen during your fall concurrent classes? So when you had concurrent but you didn't have class, what happened? And how do we handle that?
Well, in the fall, I had like specific teachers, or I was just supposed to go to the library, like they had to take roll and I had to be there for the classes that I did not have an in-person class with.
And we had the choice about that, right?
Yeah.
Is this the first year that Classen did it that way?
No.
Okay.
So, because we could decide whether you needed to do that or not.
Yeah.
And you weren't really excited about that.
No, I was not. But it did give me some experience handling some people who are not very nice.
Yeah. You've had to navigate a lot of other things with the, you know, doing the concurrent through the school and then registration at the colleges, as well as the college instructors themselves. So what have your experiences been taking concurrent classes through OCCC? And for people who don't know, how would you describe OCCC compared to UCO? OCCC is a 2-year community college.
Yes. Right? And it's also, compared to my other class, the class size is bigger, but overall, OCCC is definitely a smaller school than UCO.
Yeah, UCO is a 4-year school, and I don't know what the enrollments are. I know Oklahoma City Public Schools has an arrangement with OCCC, so if you graduate, you can actually go there for free. That's something big, though, that we should mention, is that this isn't free, right? So I think we ended up paying $600-something for classes and fees plus books for UCO in the fall, and then OCCC was about half of that. It was a little bit more than half, but it was considerably less. And do you remember if we ordered your books from Amazon, or what do we do for books? You got some OCCC books there, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm renting books.
From their bookstore?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about what you're taking at OCCC and what that is like now.
So this semester at OCCC, I'm taking a history up to the Civil War, which is an in-person class, Tuesday, Thursday. And I'm also taking an online Composition 1 class, also. And so far, I've had a really good experience with both of my classes. My professor, for my in-person history class is very attentive, and she's very knowledgeable, and I'm really enjoying that class as well. But I'm also really enjoying my online class as well. It seems to be a lot more organized and a lot more laid out, and it is a lot more, it's easier to navigate than the other one that I took was.
How have you kept yourself on track more with readings this second semester than you did the first semester?
Well, you definitely just need to make sure you're giving yourself enough time between deadlines to get your reading done, and setting time, like, I find reminders on your phone can be very helpful also, but just setting it, like, from this time to this time, I'm going to sit and I'm going to read, and that's the way it's going to be. So
it's like you make your own class time for preparation.
Yeah.
That's good. How have things been different at class in this semester in terms of your concurrent when you're not in class?
Well, this semester, my parents decided to let me be off campus for some of those times. And so when I'm not on campus at OCCC, I'm either, at a coffee shop, or sometimes I do go back to school to go to the library, but it's a lot more flexible and I have a lot more,
freedom
over what I'm doing with my schedule.
You think it was good we did it that way, or would it have been fine to do that?
I'm glad we're doing it this way.
Do you? Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What advice would you share with other students or parents who are contemplating concurrent classes?
I think if you want to take concurrent classes, you have to be ready definitely for a larger load of work. But also, if you're interested in what's college like going to be like, then it's a good stepping stone into that. But also, it's not totally exactly what college is going to be like, per se, just because you are still living at home and you are still and taking high school classes, but it definitely gives you a little taste into what college classes will be like.
Was there anything particularly surprising that you didn't expect about the whole experience?
Well, when I was taking and I guess now at OCCC too, I didn't realize there would be so many people in my class that were like older, like going back to school. But there were a few people who were, and that was nice. I mean, they're nice and everything.
So you have a more diverse class population at OCCC now than, or you did
no,
UCO as well?
No, I did at UCO as well.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed that, actually, because I just found if you have class discussions and things, people have different things to add because they've had different kinds of life experiences. What do you know now about college classes that you think will benefit you when you go to college full time? You've already talked about the readings and stuff. Is there anything else that?
I think, definitely just making sure I'm staying organized and being on top, I think, of everything. I think I'm going to get a big, calendar schedule that I'm going to have just to really line out all my due dates and all that kind of stuff, just to make sure that I'm aware of everything.
Talk about how we pick your teachers and what you've learned about that. Are you going to have a different strategy for selecting instructors, or talk about that?
Well, when I was at UCO, I actually could choose my professor, and we used Rate My Professor, but when I took at OCCC, I really didn't get to choose. They just were like, what classes? And then they just kind of just enrolled you in one. Oh. So I didn't really get to choose.
But even though we used Rate My Professor and we thought we were being all smart, I mean, it didn't all work out that great.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of just a bargain roulette thing.
Random. Well, I mean, perhaps, you know, you'll be able to talk with classmates and stuff once you get in there, you know, to find out about professors. Because I think you definitely found there are big differences in the online class experience, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
And I'm glad you've had a good experience the second go around, so that you're not ruling it out. For yourself as a learner, do you see yourself, you know, do you think the composition class itself lends itself more to the online format because it's so writing intensive? How much of that is the class and how much of that is the instructor? Or is it just both? You can't tell.
I think it's more of the class, I think. But I think the instructor has played into it as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself taking some more online classes, or you think you'll just stick with face-to-face if you have the choice?
I think if I'm in need of a more flexible scheduled class, then I think online could be a good option in the future.
And I would say for parents, just make sure you have all of your paperwork together. Make sure you have things exactly signed right. We didn't have part of our form the second time around exactly filled out right. And so, you know, at OCCC, and I guess, you know, I know they've got to have their stuff together, but it was rather frustrating to have to go all, you know, we had gone back and forth, and then we had to say, oh, sorry, we can't enroll today, and have them fill out the form completely from scratch. So make sure all the hours and everything like that are filled out, you know, on the forms that the principal and the counselor has to sign, you know, before you go and enroll. And did we have to do your birth certificate, or what were the other things that we had to do? Was it just driver's license? And
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So anything else for tips or perspectives? Has this been really the highlight, not just of your day, but your whole
the
year? Last question. What was the best part of playing Velma von Tussle in Hairspray?
It's a hard question. Probably getting to be really mean all the time.
I think you made some really good... Yeah, you had some really good relationships with some of the other people in the cast, it seemed like, and it was really good. All right, what's your dream role for college? If you could be in any show, or do you have several that would be your dream roles?
I don't know. I really want to dip into, like, some classics. Like, I'd love to be in Carousel.
Mm.
Julie Jordan, that's a top.
Okay.
Yep.
Can I ask you any more questions?
No.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. Hello. Today is Monday, March the 12th, 2018. I'm not used to saying that yet. This is Wes Fryer, and I'm here with Eric Ebert for Cassidy Voices. And Eric has been telling me over the past few weeks about some pretty innovative things that he's been doing in his computer science classes. And so I thought it would be good to sit down and visit a little bit and learn more about how GitHub and
audio podcasts and other kinds of media are fitting into his computer science curriculum. So, Eric, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're teaching now with computer science and sort of the state of the union with computer science at Cassidy, because it's a fairly new program that's been growing here.
It is fairly new. So I have always been interested in programming since I was in middle school and high school, and started programming on a Color TRS-80 back in the day. So a couple of years ago, I was hired to put a computer science program in place in the upper division. And so this year we offered 3 trimester courses. So they're meant to be introduction, what is computer science kinds of courses. We have an informatics course that tries to get students to both code and use that to model data. So next year we will be teaching that course in a language called R. We have an information security course, which is about cryptography and error correcting. How can you send a message across the internet both accurately and encrypted? So this involves quite a bit of math, but there's a huge payoff to learning that math and being able to encipher, decipher, and decrypt, cryptanalyze messages. So that's a lot of fun. And we also have an introduction to programming Python. So that course starts off just getting students used to programming constructs, what it means to be looping or what type something is, whether it's a string or a list or what have you. And it ends with some basic object-oriented programming kinds of things. And I've also had this year our first year-long course at Cassidy for quite a while. So it's the object-oriented programming applications course. We have mainly focused on creating graphical user interfaces with Python, and we've also been creating some games. So we started off creating a text-based tic-tac-toe game in Python, and we just finished up writing a trading game where the students started with some code in the book and then just took off with it. So they made it so you could trade fruit in 2 different cities, that you could add fruit to the market, that you could graph the prices at the end of the game, and they really took off with it.
Now, I just heard from Dr. Emerson that your students shared some stuff over Middlevision. Was that the program they were showing?
Yes. So we took it over to his 5th graders, and they got an opportunity to test it. It was a lot of fun for everyone. So it's an opportunity, you know, for 5th graders to get to see what kinds of things are possible. I think it's important for the interdivision interaction, so that the big kids get to share what they're doing with the younger kids, and the younger kids have role models and they can imagine themselves in doing some of these high-tech things. So they got to try and break it, submit some issues on Git. A couple of them were interested in seeing the code. So it was really a lot of fun.
That's awesome. Well, that's a good transition. You mentioned Git. So you have been using GitHub. And before we get into that, for people that don't even know, what is GitHub and why is it important in the world of programming?
So GitHub is what's called a version control system. So if you are working on a team and you're trying to write some piece of software, you need to be able to do that almost globally in today's world. So the first problem it solves is how does people all across the globe work on a project together? And so you can do that by having what's a central repository. So the repository is where you keep all your files. Basic things that you can do: you can pull a repository that already exists onto your computer and play with that code. When you have modifications, you can push that code up into the repository. And there are ways to relegate whether or not it whether it gets put into the main code base or not.
It's a moderation process,
right?
Basically. So you have gatekeepers that are the ones making sure it doesn't break stuff, and it's
legit and right. not, you know, going to do unintended things.
Exactly. So one of the other things in the software design process is you need to have the capacity to be able to break stuff. So there's a master branch, and the point of the master branch is it's always supposed to work. You can then make new branches to try and implement features or to try and correct bugs. That way you can work on the code and have no fear that the master branch is going to get broken. In particular, we had a point at which we were doing an entire rewrite. So we actually created an entire fork, which was a brand new copy of the repository. So if we broke it, no big deal. We could just go back and blow up the fork and do it again.
So when you first mentioned this to me, I thought, how awesome, because rather than use, you know, Google Classroom, or we have what we call My Cassidy, it's our student information system, but it's a typical learning management system that's course-based. You know, students are now being able to use GitHub, which is a real-world tool, and I would guess that is pretty exciting, because this is the platform, more than likely, that they're going to use as programmers and coders.
This is one of the most used platforms out there right now, for sure. And one of the things that I'm learning how to do is use Git to give constructive feedback. So there is also GitHub Classroom. So one of the things that allows me to do is I can create a repository with some template code in it, and then I can use GitHub Classroom to send that out so that every student has their own repository to submit their homework in. And so that way there's no trying to get, you know, people to put their last name on the file name so you know whose it is. It just all ends up in one repository for a single student.
And kind of like Google Classroom, it simplifies that whole process of file exchange.
Yes.
Who has it? Who's turned it in? Has somebody not turned it in? That kind of stuff.
One of the things that I want to play with is called Travis CI, which is an automated testing system. So one of the things that people try and do in the software development process is write unit tests so that you can test your code. So I'd like to get this kind of connected with some of the student assignments so that they can see when they submit whether or not it's working the way it's supposed to or not.
I want to ask you about media and podcasting, but something that just occurred to me is, you know, collaboration versus individual effort. How does that play out in the class, and is there much tension there between collaborating and working together and individual effort? Or, you know, because obviously collaboration is really big, but we still have assessment pieces that, you know, students are getting grades. So what does that feel like, and how are you walking that line with these students?
It's been interesting. So I started off the year reading this book called Teaching with Your Mouth Shut by Donald Finkel. And so I've been kind of trying to do some of those things that inspired me, some things that I've been trying around project-based learning.
Is that more Socratic approaches, or what? I'm not familiar with that. So how would you generalize this approach?
A lot of it, I would say, is giving more, empowering students. I think that is really, the overwhelming thing that I took away from that is empowering student voice. And so I've always kind of had more of a, I don't know, the classroom structure in one of my classrooms has always been a little flatter. Don't try and interact with the students, more as a guide or a mentor. And so I've tried to get them going on projects and then kind of slowly step out of the process. And with this trading game project, over the last week or week and a half, it got a little weird from my end because I no longer had any role in the classroom. I had them in two different groups because they were finishing off the last two pieces of the program, and I would go into the classroom, they would check in with me, and then it was from there on they were doing what they needed to do to finish up the project. Another interesting thing that kind of came out of that was when you have four people trying to crowd around a laptop, it gets a little hard for them to interact with each other, so I had them put it up on the smart board. And so there was one day that they used the smart board in the classroom I'm in, and then I had them go down to another classroom in Hightower so that they could use the TV that is in that particular room. And one of the things that I learned about that was that they really didn't like being in two different places, let alone two different buildings. Mm. So it worked very well for them to share with each other, but it also emphasized on me the need for collaborative spaces and flex spaces. Mm-hmm. And spaces so that they can be in the same room and collaborate together, yet be able to ask other groups about code they didn't write.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about media. So you've played a little bit with podcasts. Talk a little bit about that and what you've done so far, and what you've seen in terms of the benefits to students using audio podcasts.
I've been searching kind of, so one of the other things Donald Finkel talks about in his book is doing reflection and the importance of reflection, and I'm a hyper-reflective individual as it is, so I wanted to find some way to put this into the classroom. And so podcasting kind of came out as a natural way to do that, and we used it as a way to document the project, and there's things around digital citizenship that you can talk about, and that you're, you know, posting this to the world, that other people are going to hear what you're doing. And it was kind of one of the interesting things as I've been putting this on SoundCloud. One day one of the kids logged into SoundCloud and said, oh, there's people following us that are, you know, on the other side of the country. So it made it very real that what they're doing and what they're posting is being seen by other people.
Authentic audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so did you use a rubric, or what was the assignment as students reflected? And which project was that? That was a while back, right?
That was the trading game project.
Oh, it was. Okay.
And so I had them, I set up a schedule so that one or two people were assigned to a Monday and one or two people were assigned to a Friday. And so they had some leeway about when they recorded it, but kind of the point was, for those at the beginning of the week to talk to others in the other groups, find out what the goals were for that week, what they were hoping to accomplish, what stumbling blocks had come up, and to talk about those things, in the podcast. And then, for whoever had the end of the week was, you know, what did we accomplish? What are we looking forward to in the coming week and things like that? And it also gives kids an opportunity to be creative, play with technology. So there's one of them that has intro music and ending music. So I had one of the students do one, and I'd learned some things about the software design process. So I also did one. So I smashed them together in GarageBand, and I put a ad for the musical in the middle of it. So, I mean, it's just, you know, outlet for creativity, outlet for student voices, et cetera.
Awesome. Well, what's next? What are your projects, and what are you thinking about experimenting with, or in terms of media? You mentioned maybe vlogs. What kinds of things are on the horizon for you?
So our next project is a Yahtzee project. So we're gonna try and implement the Yahtzee game in Java. And so with the trading game, they went out and found the things that they didn't know how to do. And so, which is fantastic. So we're gonna kind of come back and, make sure that everybody has knows what generics are, knows how to construct objects, you know, they're in there somewhere.
But this is all in Python, this up to this point?
This is in Java.
Oh, this is
We've
Java.
Been doing this in Java. And so our next project is the Yahtzee. It is much easier if you can sort the dice in order. And so they last Thursday and Friday worked on how to implement the bubble sort algorithm, which isn't very efficient, but it's usually the first sorting algorithm people learn. And so that's going to become a part of the Yahtzee game, and that's kind of the direction we're headed. As far as media goes, I started off the year, our first big project I had, it was when they were first learning how to do graphical user interfaces. Everybody had kind of a different component that they had to present to the class. And so I also gave them all different media types. So, one had to do a screencast, one put up a web page. I think there was a podcast and some other things. And one of the points that I wanted to come from that was, with these different media types, you can accomplish different things, or some things are easier in one media type than another. So I hope to kind of continue to explore media, continue to explore with students what can be accomplished with particular types of media, etc.
Awesome. Where can people get in touch with you online as far as?
So I'm at ebert@cassidy.org is my email. I am on Twitter as Biggest Mao. I also have a LinkedIn profile that's pretty easily found as well. So
awesome. And we're going to be putting this on Anchor. We originally had been using the Opinion app, which was hosting, but it changed. And so if you found your way here, you may have found it through anchor.fm/Cassidy. So thanks so much for sharing, and we'll look forward to checking in with you later on as you continue this exciting journey.
Well, hello. Today is Monday, March the 12th, 2018. This is Wes Fryer. I'm here with my beautiful wife, Shelley, who has graciously agreed to a podcast interview about coding because she has been doing all kinds of things about coding. So welcome to the podcast, Shelley.
Well, thank you.
Can you share?
So nice to be here with you on the couch today.
Can you share a little about your teaching and classroom situation now and how that has changed in the past year?
This year, I have started a new teaching adventure. I am a third grade language arts teacher at Cassidy School. So Wes has been the technology director there for 2 years now. And our daughter, Rachel, is now an eighth grader there. So there was a surprise job opening, in the summer. They went from 3 classrooms to 4 classrooms. And so I applied and started working there. I guess got the job in July and started working there in August. So I am language arts. So I see, and I have 25 students in my language arts classrooms.
So what have you been doing lately with coding in your classroom?
Well, you know, it's kind of morphed because I am language arts, but I still have this love for computer science and making and creating. I'm trying to weave that in to my language arts classroom. I just started with PBS Scratch Junior, which is always my first love. And because they are so familiar with the characters, and just did some introduction lessons during a Maker Studio time that it's kind of a homeroom time twice a week that we have. But now my students are familiar with coding, and so now they're coding their spelling words and they're coding stories, and so now they're being able to apply and adapt coding into their literacy stations.
And for people who don't know, describe what PBS Scratch Junior is, and then a little bit about your computing situation, because previously your kids were one-to-one with iPads, and now this has been quite a bit different this year.
Right. Okay, so two questions. Scratch Junior is a junior version of the Scratch programming language that's put out by MIT, part of Mitch Resnick's Lifelong Kindergarten Group. And a few years ago, PBS came out with a Scratch Junior. It's PBS Scratch Junior, so it's fully functioning Scratch Junior, but it uses the PBS characters. So that's the one I kind of always start with, is PBS Scratch Junior.
And it is a tablet-only
Yes, app. It's an iOS tablet-only device.
Well, on Android as well. Well, we haven't used it on Android, but it is.
Right.
It's both. But you can't use it on the web, can't use it on a Chromebook,
no.
You gotta use it on a tablet.
Correct. And it was made originally for, I would say kindergarten through third grade. I've always started my third graders on it. It's just a really easy interface. I mean, it has a very low bar, meaning that it's very easy, but it has a very high ceiling and that there's a lot of creativity that can come into, and it is block-based coding.
Like Lego bricks, kids are snapping stuff together and being able to come up with algorithms that tell stories, make sprites move, doing animations.
We've created games, we've done animations, we've done stories, and so, and I think it gives a good foundational language, for Scratch, and it's easy, you know, so that's where I've always tended to start.
And you have a shared iPad situation, so
yes,
how's
we
that
have five classroom iPads, and they're just kind of a mixture of whatever we weren't using at home.
Most of them are our own, actually.
Yeah, they're our
There's
own
only
that
one
we've kind of
schools.
Yeah, and then at the office we can check out. There's five iPads in the office that we can check out, and we share that with the whole building. And then occasionally, I get some of the library iPads in my classroom and they're not being used. So, yes, for the past 4 years, I had taught in a one-to-one environment, and now I'm in a shared iPad environment, which works. I mean, paired coding is wonderful. And the students have learned how to share that, the iPads, and so that's worked out great.
So what interests and inspires you to help students learn coding at all?
I really see coding and really the computer science as a language. I think it's something that eventually we will all share in having, just like we have music class and art class, and I think we'll need to have a computer science class. I think the way I see, especially in the elementary, is that it is something that we need to be able to weave into our regular class subjects. You know, teachers cannot deal with teaching one more thing in the classroom. There's just really not enough, you know, hours in the day. But I think in order to even make this accessible and relevant, we need to find ways to integrate it into what we're already doing in the classroom. So I have a spelling station, and coding your spelling words is just one way that you can show what you know. And just like putting in an ABC order or listing it, you know, red and blue vowels or however teachers are doing that at their literacy stations. Coding is just one way. So not teaching it necessarily as a separate subject, but I really love playing with ways that I can integrate it into what I'm already doing. So I think that's the way I like to look at coding. And I think that's going to be the way ultimately that we all need to look at that, just as a language. So
you have just wrapped up a after school class for first and second graders using PBS Scratch Junior. Last semester, I think you did third and fourth.
Yes.
What stands out for you from this last class series with the first and second graders, especially as you contrast that with what the third and fourth graders did?
Well, number one, I love coding with my firsties, my first and second graders. They come to this so eager. I love the structure of the iPad. And in those cases, I do make sure, like I have 13 in my first and second grade group, and I make sure that we are one-to-one iPads when we're doing that. And I think that's really important because they all want to have hands-on. And if I had them in my classroom, we would work more on social skills and sharing. But when it's in an afternoon club, man, we just need to hit the ground running with our coding. So I do make sure that I have one-to-one iPads for the first and second graders. Well, really, anytime I'm using my after-school club. What I love about the first and second graders is that they're fearless. You know, they just jump right in there. Sometimes it's a little bit of a struggle because they're not reading and writing as much. Not that this is not dependent on that at all, but when we started writing in conversations and using texting blocks. But I tell you, speech to text is available on most of the iPads, and so they learned how to do speech to text really quick. Which was fun. So their creativity is a lot different. I think the older students have done so much gaming already that they kind of have a, preconceived of what they want to do, whereas I see the first and second graders are just kind of on the spot creating. And it's almost just like magic, you know, when you're coding something and you teach them how to use the, you know, the conversation block and then to put it full screen and all of a sudden, wow, you know, just their reactions. And they call it, they're making movies and they like, okay, now I'm going to go watch my movie. And so they'll switch over to full screen and then they'll run their program and, you know, they just get so tickled and so excited because to them it's just like, it's something that they've created, and then it comes to life.
Well, there's a magic and a discovery there that this is why teaching these programs to a room of adults absolutely feels so different and dead,
right?
Compared to how that can be with kids.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're excited, and they want to show you. You know, you almost don't. You're trying to help somebody figure out a problem or debug something, and then I want to show you, you know, and so. So having that time to show and to share is really important. They get really excited and they want to show you their work.
Well, that's one of the things I think you continue to do a wonderful job of with Seesaw and with videos is asking kids to, you know, show me what you've created mm-hmm. and tell me. What are some of the questions you ask children in those moments when you're wanting them to show and tell?
Oh, it's hard to say because I just kind of do it on the spot. But, well, usually we watch their program and they show it how it works and then, and sometimes we read along with it. And then it's like, well, show me your code underneath, you know, so what are some of the coding that you had to do? Can you show us your code? And then I usually have them read the code, especially with first and second graders, because coding is, you know, it's left to right in PBS Scratch Junior. And so it's just that practice of left to right reading,
right.
Which is a reading skill.
Well, it literally is.
Yeah, it literally is.
It's like iMovie in the storyboard or whatever
and,
down on the bottom.
And it is very visual.
Right.
And so they can read the code left to right and know what's going to happen. And that's part of the computational, you know, if I do this, then this is going to happen. And then I want this to happen. And so they're kind of reading through that. And so it's a great reading skills practice in some ways. So I forgot what the question was.
Well, what you ask them is you ask them to explain
okay.
it.
So, yeah, I always have them explain their code underneath. And then I always ask them, so what do you think about coding? How are you feeling about that? So some way that they can kind of begin to internalize, you know, what they're feeling. So,
yeah.
And sometimes it's, you know, oh, where'd you get the idea to do that or to have that, you know,
right.
character disappear, you
right.
know? And so just getting them to kind of share where they're getting their ideas and ask them questions about what they were thinking and can you tell me more about and just leading them to try to verbalize.
Yeah, articulating and communicating.
Mm-hmm. And that is something else that I've noticed with the first and second graders. It takes a lot of practice to be able to do that. You have to really think. I mean,
for them to be able to explain.
Yeah,
it.
For them to be able to explain their thinking is a whole
Which
different
is metacognition.
Skill. Exactly.
That is metacognition.
Yeah. And so being able to explain, in fact, I had one parent write me an email saying, you know, thank you for getting him to explain that because sometimes verbalizing is a very difficult skill and you need to practice it. And that's probably not something that we practice a whole lot of.
Yeah.
So,
but it's really a vital part of the puzzle, I think, because it's reflecting, it's deepening that understanding.
And it's just a communication.
Right. It's developing that capacity to be able to teach and to explain.
Right.
So how did things go using the videos by Adeolu Owakade, who is DHAC, well, I know it's DHAC Institute. We'll put in the show notes his direct Twitter link. You used his videos for the Scratch Club this semester. How'd that come about?
I did. Well, it just goes back. This is one of those when you develop your PLN, your and this is a
professional learning network.
And a year ago, I was doing some. I think I was looking into some coding robots. Some robots that I had never heard before and I kind of tweeted out, has anybody used these? And I got a response back from him and we're probably butchering your name. But, and anyway, he's a, computer science guy out of Nigeria and he is offering some clubs and after school and things like that in coding in Nigeria because they wanted their students to have, I mean, what we all,
Well, it's a lot like the DIV. We have a wonderful group in Edmond called the DIV. Shout out to Michaelin Danner, who heads it up. And they're partnered now with Code.org, which we'll talk a little bit about here in a bit. But, you know, their focus is saying we need kids to have experiences with coding, and we can't just wait for, you know, the state or the school to mandate or whatever. We need to find ways to bring these coding experiences to kids. Yes. So it really sounds to me like they're doing a similar thing in Nigeria.
Exactly. So, I mean, I would love to meet or maybe at a conference or something sometime. But so he developed these coding lessons for Scratch, regular Scratch. And I have been exposed to Scratch. I mean, you've done a couple workshops for the DIV, but I always felt just overwhelmed, even in a student workshop. And so I started looking at his mini lessons, and they're a lot like some of the mini lessons that I did for Scratch Junior. So, just chunking it and taking that in small bite-sized pieces from an introduction. Nothing longer than maybe 4 to 6 minutes. These little mini lessons, and they're free, and so you can sign up for them, and it takes you through step by step. So it was perfect for my after school Scratch Club, which is the regular Scratch that we're doing on the Chromebooks. And so, we do a mini lesson during it's about an hour that we have for a coding club after school. So we do a mini lesson and then we practice those skills and the kids recreate something using the skills that they've learned in the video. And I think we've made it through about half of them. We have one more coding class left, I think, after spring break. But they have been fabulous, absolutely fabulous, because it stair steps and it builds and it scaffolds the lessons.
The building blocks.
Yeah, and yes, I love Scratch in that you can kind of jump in there and make and create and look and analyze. But I also love that because I love these lessons because there's a lot of things that, like you said, you have found ways to do things. But this has made it a little easier skills.
Quality code is often elegant like poetry. And so we had a situation actually last week. Well, it was a couple weeks ago, but anyway, with Ivan and he had wanted to make, a Canon shoot. In fact, I think we can put a link to we recorded a video and tweeted it out. We put it on Seesaw. Anyway, I helped him do it, but I had thought of a very complicated way. And because of the blocks that they were exposed to, and I think his own exploration, he found a much more elegant way of using a block.
Which fewer steps.
Basically, it keeps the bullet at the same location as the cannon, and then it was underneath it. And anyway, it wasn't using X and Y coordinate, you know, things or whatever. And so it was a good thing.
Yeah. So anyway, I have absolutely loved them. It's a great way for students to go through some self-taught lessons. You know, you can go through it individually.
And like code.org to have a place to go
exactly.
So they can continue their learning.
Yes.
Because we've only got a few, 8 weeks or whatever with them. Mm-hmm. And so they can continue.
So, but I've also loved it in our coding club. It's just been a great way to scaffold their learning, to take it in small bite-sized pieces, perfect for an after-school club, you know, where you're just limited on time, introduces them to blocks that do different things and some of the little intricacies, you know, when you're just kind of starting out. And then we have set up a web page where we all are connected, and so we like and they share each other's projects, and that's been really awesome too.
Yeah, we'll include that in the show notes too. Yeah. But that's just your classroom website,
mm-hmm. right? Right.
MrsFryer.Cassidy.org, and then click the link for Scratch.
Right.
Well, this one isn't on our list of questions, but how have you balanced students wanting to play games and just spend time in really, in many cases, complicated Scratch projects? Or learning and applying those lessons from those videos and developing their own skills.
Well, there is no doubt that kids love and enjoy playing games on the computer. And they love doing it in Minecraft and they love doing it, you know, in Roblox. They love. And so Scratch has a huge community where a lot of shared projects have been put in there and they love, going through those and playing those and watching those projects. In Coding Club, again, we're limited on time. And so we try to keep, them working on the project, whatever skill we've learned that day, and keep them in that. Sometimes they'll find the simplest game, like there was some dinosaur game and he was jumping over things and it looked so basic. One of the first lessons we learned in the DAC Institute was like how to go to other projects and then look inside and how you can copy and edit projects.
Remix them.
Remix them, yes. Remixing projects. So and they found this dinosaur. Well, when we looked at the code underneath, whoa, we were just blown away with the amount of code that it was created, this small, seemingly very simple game. And so very, you know, in one way, when they were trying to remix it, it became very overwhelming because there was just too much code. But they did find ways of adding their own, you know, recoloring blocks or doing backgrounds or whatever. I was really amazed that they were able to dig into that. But it just sets the bar so high where they want to create something that's so complex and they're still kind of at the toddling stage. And so there's a balance there.
And I've noticed it's different with certain kids. Certain mm-hmm. kids it gravitate is. To that more. And
it
I was
is.
Really proud of several of our kids with what they created and the ways they were kind of tenacious, oh. you know, going back mm-hmm. on their projects week after week and how they've built them and added to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be excited as we have sometimes after, you know, a Scratch Day event where we have links to kids' Scratch accounts
yeah.
to see what they're going to continue to
well,
do.
Well, and what I really love is that you can very easily see those kids that just gravitate naturally and are just analytical thinkers and who are thinking through things.
Computational.
I have several students and you can tell they really get this. You know, and it's just something that
a way to apply their
yes,
mind.
Yes, but Finn is an outstanding, and he remembers and he can help others. And
well,
Alexander,
didn't you say it was
too.
Just a lifesaver to have him with
the
first and
well,
second graders?
Yeah, I pick one of my coding club kids to help me with the first and second graders, and he is. He's just because it really sometimes takes a couple students just to kind of dig in and help. One student that really amazed me, you know, we have out of how many students we have in our eight
mm-hmm.
in our,
ten,
our
ten or
scratch, ten. Maybe more, two of them are girls. So it's another thing that, you know, we just advertise coding and the parents sign the kids up, but we only wound up with two girls out of 10, you know, students in all, eight boys, two girls maybe. So we've got to find ways to change. I think, well, okay, let me tell you this story first and I'll tell you some ideas and thoughts I have. Well, I've got one, student. She's one of my language arts students, but she's also in the afternoon coding club. She's very artistic. She's very gifted. Creativity. I mean, she's just a very creative child. So she's very, into Minecraft and she's very into video. Her last book report was done on video.
Well, she's the one that built it in Minecraft, wasn't she?
Yes.
And she videoed
yes,
her Minecraft
world. Yes. She did
awesome.
It in Minecraft and, her last book report. And so anyway, she's been working on a game in Scratch Coding Club and it's a ballerina who's playing soccer. And so she's, you know, she's continued to build. Like today, she wanted to keep score. So she wanted the ballerina to avoid the soccer ball because, you know, ballerinas don't want to get hit by the soccer ball. That would not be good if the ballerina. So rather than trying the ballerina kicking the soccer ball, the ballerina was trying to avoid the soccer ball. And if she could get to the goal, then she scored a point, you know, by avoiding the soccer ball. Anyway, and so she was trying to figure out a way to calculate her points. But I think she just comes at it, you know, from a whole different.
And you guys figured that out
yeah,
together.
Yeah, we did.
Didn't you?
Yeah,
how
we
to,
did.
How to create a variable?
I was like, okay, I'm going to go Google it. And so we Googled it and then we followed it and we figured out how to, yeah, do the variable and we had to create a data point. And, so it was great. At some point she kind of looked at me sideways though and said, could Dr. Fryer come help me? I was like, no, I can help you. I can figure this out. But we were having to do it together. You
that
know,
was awesome.
we were doing it together.
And what
so.
That gave us a chance to do when we talked about with the kids, several mm-hmm. of them, is initial conditions.
Yeah.
And the beginning of your game, you know, cause and that's just kind of the progression of how that happens because they'll have something occur. But then when you play it again, you're like, well, that character wasn't on the left side of the screen or that background wasn't right. And so. Anyway, I love that because it is a way of thinking computationally, mm-hmm. and you're starting to think like a game designer, mm-hmm. because that's what game designers have to think, and they're having all kinds of conversations about, you know, is that too hard? Is that too easy? Well, what can I do? How, you know, can I make it faster or slower? Can I make the character bigger or smaller? And, you know, it's just, I love that. Love.
Yeah, well, I just, I love that. Well, and then going back to getting more girls in coding club, I think we just really have to also watch and how we're describing it, you know? And I don't think girls are afraid of it. I just think girls don't quite know what it is.
Yeah.
And so, and a lot of girls at this point aren't, I mean, I do have a lot of gamers, a lot of girl gamers. I really do. But when you're start coding, whatever, that doesn't necessarily.
We need to worry about what we call it.
Yeah,
and we need to
it
call
is.
It
it's
about
game design and or put the word creativity, creative.
Well,
in
I was
it.
Listening to,
I mean,
the part of the audio podcast that we recorded at our computer science retreat back in August, mm-hmm. and we had some great ideas. And Eric Ebert and Jason Reich were talking about this very question as far as wearables. Or no, mm-hmm. I've actually, Glenn Emerson was talking about wearables, but they were, you know, how can we address this issue? Yeah. What are the things
and
we
it's
can
not
do?
Just artsy, craftsy either. I mean, girls, like, she was coding a game, and she was, and it was complex. But I just somehow, and let's face it, these are first through third graders, and they're
well,
not signing themselves up. The parents are signing them up. You know, parents have got to know that there are doors being opened and they need to get their girls into that doorway.
Computational thinking,
you know,
is a literacy skill for everyone.
Not just,
it's not just
the girls not going to jump and say, hey, I want to go to coding club, or boys either for that matter. It's their parents that are signing them up. And so, you know, communicating to
parents.
Maybe
we need digital art club, or we need animation club, or something like
yeah.
that.
So, I don't know, but,
tell us about your recent experiences in San Antonio with Code.org.
Well, so I've always worked with Scratch. And then Wes mentioned the Div earlier, and McKaylin had to say, hey, and they happen to be regional partners with Code.org. And so they've been working with Code.org to train teachers for middle school and high school coding classes. And they've just started their computer science fundamentals for K through 5. And so they were needing teachers to train other teachers. And so anyway, I got accepted. So I'm one of like three trainers now in Oklahoma, who have been trained to train other educators on how to integrate computer science skills into their classrooms. And so, I got to go to San Antonio for some training and, loved it. What I really love about Code.org is that they make it so that you don't have to have the technology. They do a lot of unplugged activities as well. There's a lot of unplugged activities that you can do to introduce computer science skills into your classroom. Again, it doesn't have to be just a separate computer science class or coding class. It can be, you know, I'm thinking about integrating some of the activities into my morning meeting, my classroom meeting, as kind of a game, or maybe a math activity, or maybe a language arts time where we're explaining procedures and steps, but just ways to begin integrating that language and those skills and but not necessarily as a separate. I mean, it'd be great if we could have a separate computer, you know, science class, and maybe that's once a month or in a maker's time or something, but kind of like you do a big art projects or something. But anyway, I was really thrilled with the way that Code.org is working with their trainers and introducing this in a way that it makes it easy for classroom teachers to understand. It makes it easy for classroom teachers to integrate it into their classrooms and to break it down into modules. And then they have, you know, you sign your class up and they have a series of modules on the computer that takes the students through this series of, classes, you know, step by step. So, very well organized, very well done. One of the most professional staff development trainings I've ever been to.
And, like, there were people from all over the United States there?
All over, yeah, all over the United States, from coast to coast. You know, there were representatives from every state, really.
One of the things you came back telling me about was that you all had a good conversation about equity. Can you speak to that a little bit?
We spent almost a half afternoon on equity and what does equity look like, in a computer science classroom and talking about, what every child needs, you know. Equal and equity are two different things. Equal is when everybody gets the same amount. Equity is every child gets what they need. And so, you know, even within a single classroom, there may be some students that need more help, more support, more than another student, you know. So how are we going to scaffold our classroom and our lessons so that every child gets what they need, you know? And sometimes it has to do with the technology itself. You know, there are a lot of classrooms that don't have the technology and their, you know, access and accessibility to that. There are a lot of kids that don't have access to technology at home. Yet these are important skills that they're going to use as they're growing up. And, you know, it's hard pressed to think of a job that doesn't have some bit of computer or computer science in it, you know? And so this is just really a life skill that we need to make sure is built into. And even if in those cases you're not doing it, I mean, you could still do an unplugged activity. You can still do unplugged, you know, you could still at least introduce vocabulary and computational thinking and all of that, you know, without the technology. But one thing that I'm really challenged now that I've kind of gotten my first year at Cassidy under my belt is that I really want to reach out to maybe the Boys and Girls Club, or I would love to go teach an after school coding club at Positive Tomorrows, or reaching out to you know, other sources, libraries maybe, and being able to offer this
through service learning or some through other service learning. That we have.
Yeah.
Wouldn't
yeah.
it be great to get some of your kids
who
are developing these mm-hmm. coding skills? And that's one of the things
yeah.
I'm most excited about, is to see these kids developing their skills, looking at them going on to the next grade, mm-hmm. moving up, you know, at our school,
right.
and then having those skills to possibly use to help mm-hmm. others and to apply within their classes and to be able to say, well, could I make a simulation for that? Could I make a game
yeah.
for that?
Well, I had, you know, we just finished our big unit on chocolate. We were talking about fair trade chocolate and so one of our last activities is that we had a maker studio and they could make and create anything, but it had to have something to do where they would show me what they know that we learned during our chocolate unit. And so I had a couple boys say, well, can I go get a Chromebook? Can we do Scratch? I said, sure, it's got to be about chocolate. So we had talked about and illustrated the chocolate making process. And so one of them built a chocolate mixer and he coded it to show how the mixing of the chocolate. I think we could link that. That's mm-hmm. Finn's. We could link that project to the show notes. And then another student did the rainforest, and he showed how the cocoa pods were fermenting during the fermenting process, and he coated that the banana leaves on top and then the banana leaves coming over, and he had a background of the rainforest, and he even had the water, you know, that you could hear the sound of the rainforest. Yeah. So, I mean, just, and I didn't help him. My one condition was make and create something, but show me what you know that you learned during our chocolate unit. And so that was awesome. And so they are beginning to, you know, it does take some time to build the foundation and the skills and the capacity, with the different apps and things. But my favorite part in the year is when they begin to, synthesize that information and translate it into other projects.
Well, and make choices about the kind of media they want to make
mm-hmm.
and the way they want to represent that.
Right.
'Cause their toolbox has become larger.
Exactly.
And they know they can draw into
mm-hmm.
that toolbox
right.
to be able to represent ideas and to put things in motion
and
make
it
multisensory.
They know that it's a tool. It's
yeah.
not the project, you know.
Right.
It's not a scratch part. It's a tool that we use to showcase what we know,
right.
you know.
Absolutely.
And so it's just the tool, like the pencil or the markers or the whatever. It's just the tool that they choose to use to show, you know, that information. And so that's when I know it's taking us higher in that SAMR model,
yeah.
you know.
That's right.
So when they're being able to apply that information.
Look at you using all your
acronyms. I know. I'm trying to throw in as many of those as I can. It makes me sound smart.
As soon as you say SAMR, like, everyone's impressed. All right. So what advice do you have for other teachers interested in bringing coding and a focus on computational thinking to their students, classroom, and school?
Well, I definitely would encourage you to check out code.org. Code.org makes it so easy for teachers to be able to pick that up and just begin. You know, you can just begin with that. And they do make it, it's very well laid out. I love Scratch Junior, and Scratch has a lot of built-in places where you can go to get lesson ideas and step-by-step. And PBS Digital Learning Media also has lessons if you get access to those. Those are all free, so you can get lessons to those and videos of, you know, using those in a classroom. I think number one, just do it, you know. So many people are afraid that it's just one more thing, but you can take a 30-minute lesson and teach that and realize these kids just take to it. It's like, you know, they're so engaged. They're so interested. They want to do it. Just the engagement and the excitement is encouraging to say, hey, this works. These kids, they're just taking it. They can do this.
And to throw some big tech words at pedagogy, I mean, the pedagogy here is kids are having active agency over the technology. They are creating and writing the code, not just being subjected to code that's been created by others. Mm-hmm. And that is an essential skill for today's day and age, when the Facebook feed and, you know, Twitter, and there's so many different ways we feel manipulated by social media. Well, those are algorithms that have all been created by different people. And so it is powerful to help our students learn to create the algorithm.
Right. And even if they don't necessarily, I think they just come to appreciate, you know, how something is made and how it can look. Because today we went back, we're preparing our class, speaking of, our class is going to go to a first grade. Actually, the first grade classroom is coming to us. So we have,
tomorrow.
We have a first grade class coming to our classroom, and we're going to partner up with them. We're going to go through a basic introduction lesson to Scratch Junior, PBS Scratch Junior, and then they're going to get, they're going to work with a first grader to do some coding. And when we went back today to watch that introductory video to make sure everybody, I didn't want them to get too complicated. I wanted them to know that it has to be simple. We have to start simple, and you have to put yourself in the role. We're doing paired coding. So the first graders, we talked about, the first graders have the wheel. They're the ones driving. And so, anyway, they really like that analogy. Where was I going with this?
They gotta start simple. They can't just,
so yeah, we've gotta start simple. But anyway, I mean, so one of my students says, oh man, I wish I could get my Scratch project to do that. It was so easy in Scratch Junior. I wish I could get they realize the complexity of the coding that they're using. So I was really glad that my Scratch Club kids had PBS Junior first, because it kind of gave them the big picture and the confidence. And so now I said, well, I am sure that there is a way to do it. We just have to figure it out.
Well, I'm so thrilled that you're doing that between classes, because we know there's tremendous value in students mentoring each other, the ways that they pay attention and learn from older, you know, students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, today Eric Ebert took his high school upper division coding class over to middle division to Glenn Emerson's fifth graders, and they showed him a simulation in a game they had made, and the fifth graders put it through its paces. I'm like,
that's
this is awesome. So awesome.
That is.
So, you know, sometimes we get frustrated at thinking that things aren't changing and whatever, but when you hear these stories and you've, you know, experienced that excitement of the kids, and just like, you know, Whitney Finley's high school seniors going over to primary division with the books that they made and the e-books, you know, there's just That stuff is awesome.
Well, and that is a huge advantage over being on one campus, that we have that. We could easily, you know, bring students from the high school to the primary or, you know, into the middle division. And so being on one campus,
right,
and being able to have those connections is wonderful. It's all a right. big benefit.
Last question for you. What is next for you with coding?
Well, I think, well, number one, I would love to get a group of teachers together so that I can just practice teaching teachers. I'm really comfortable teaching the students, and but I feel like I want to run through a coding introductions, coding fundamentals, computer science fundamentals.
With code.org.
Yes, with the code.org stuff. And I would love to have a guinea pig group and go through that. Number two, I'm going to do a hoping a code.org class this summer as a summer camp. You know, they have four day camps. And so I want to work with that. I want to do a lot of the unplugged activities. I want to take some more time, to do some things. So I'm looking forward to that.
You have dreams of going to Boston?
I do. I have dreams of going to Boston. So, there is a, scratch coding
conference
at MIT, and I would love to go and be involved in that.
In July. And we may do another Scratch Day. Usually April, I think, is when Scratch Day happens,
right.
And so we'll have to see. And if you're in the Oklahoma City area, and well, wherever you are, you know, get involved. Find out who's doing a Scratch Day, and if no one's doing one, then offer to do one yourself. And
absolutely,
I would love to see more sharing of the kind of projects, and maybe we can get some of our kids who've created these projects involved, you know, doing more show and tell with things that they've made, because that can be so inspiring.
Well,
to see
that I think sometimes has been the hardest. One of my hurdle is how to, like, I love Seesaw and I can video with my camera, but ways that we can share out our learning, not just to the Scratch community, but parents. I mean, I really think we need to be speaking to our stakeholders. We need to be speaking to our administrators. We need to speak to other teachers. We need to be, you know, speaking to parents. We need to be showing the value in what we're doing. I know that they see the kids' excitement. They tell me that their kids are excited and they've loved this coding, you know, interaction, but I want them to see that this is not just fun and games.
It's not just
this
games,
is,
right.
Yeah.
Well, really to see the thinking. That's the making the invisible visible,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Trying to uncover the thinking and making that visible for them to be able to see.
Yeah.
All right. Well, where can people connect with you if they'd like to follow you and learn more from you?
Mrs. Fryer at Cassidy.org.
Cassidy.org. Right.
Mrs. Yeah. Fryer. Cassidy.org.
Changing your website every 3 years.
Yeah,
so
whatever.
Making it hard.
So S. Fryer on Twitter. Those are the best two ways to find mine. I have not been blogging very much because this has just been such an involved year. But I really look to start blogging some of my experiences this year, some of my takeaways from moving into a language arts classroom, moving to the opposite end of the educational spectrum from where I was teaching before. So it's been a big learning year for me, but I need to and want to start getting that out there.
And that'll be at ShellyFryer.com.
Yep.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening.
Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcast are independently produced by Wesley Fryer and are licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Only license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.